Hello, and welcome to another edition of the Gobeski Wallace Report. My name is Charlie Wallace.
And I'm Adam Gobeski, and please welcome our four guests. We have regular contributors Paul Wilcox.
It's great to be back.
And Doug Gobeski.
Hello.
Semi-regular contributor Kevin Vredevoog.
Hey, excited to be here.
And special guest, occasional contributor. What is that? Very special?
Irregular.
Yes. Our irregular special guest, Dan Hess.
I'd rather be special than irregular, I suppose, but I'll take it.
We are discussing the 10th episode in our sci-fi shuffle. Last time, Doug picked the 1975 film Dark Star, first film from John Carpenter. So remind us, Doug, why did you pick this movie?
Well, I picked this movie because you said we couldn't do anything from the 2010s.
What's the opposite of the 2010s? 1975.
The initial premiere of this movie was actually 50 years ago this past week.
But that was not the version we watched, is my understanding.
Well, I mean, sure, but I didn't want to wait like a year and a half.
Oh, that's the reason you chose it?
I mean, 50 is a nice big round number, yeah.
Is that actually the reason you chose it, or is that a coincidence?
That's mainly a coincidence, other than I was, okay, what movies do we have from the 1970s? Well, we could do Zardoz, we could do Dark Star. I haven't seen Dark Star before. I've heard it's about AI, at least peripherally. Let's try that. And plus, you know, it's John Carpenter, so I figure, you know, worst case, there's got to be a floor to the quality there, right? Like, there's no way it can be that bad.
Have you seen some of John Carpenter's later works?
Nope.
Okay. Just asking questions here.
Just asking questions.
Is there anything in particular to which you are referring?
My understanding is some of his later works, like Ghosts of Mars, are not particularly well regarded.
That was the first one that came to my mind when then we were talking about the floor.
So you're saying you would not have preferred that I pick that instead?
So had anyone seen this movie before?
Not going to answer that, huh?
I had not seen this movie, nor had I heard of it. I was unaware of its existence.
Same.
Same. No, wait. But for real, I had not actually seen it before. And the ratings it got were fair, so not great. So I was like, we could do something that's not a pillar of the genre. So
I hadn't seen this movie before. I'm a fan of the John Carpenter stuff I've seen, so I was kind of excited to see it, but didn't really see it on my own because I knew it was his first and thought maybe it'd be more of a curiosity than maybe one of his better movies, but I didn't really know. And I still haven't done any background research, so I'm excited to hear about that.
I was in the same camp, but like 3 ago, where I was not even really aware of its existence until your announcement, Doug.
Well, I guess I'm the odd person out. I had heard of it 5 years ago at this point. I found a copy of the DVD at a Goodwill. It looks like a bootleg, but as far as I can tell, it is a real copy, despite looking so much like a bootleg. But
I would be disappointed if the box looked like anything other than a bootleg.
Yeah. So I watched it at the time, and then in preparation for this, I actually watched both the what is called the original edition, the shorter one, and the theatrical cut. So I've actually seen both, so I can talk a little bit about that as well.
Ah, thank you for doing my homework.
Excellent, because later on, I have some guesses as to what the extra 15 minutes
ooh,
were.
Me too.
And I have not looked it up, so I want to know if I'm right or wrong. It'll be a game we can play.
Sounds good. So Dark Star started out as a student project for John Carpenter and Dan O'Bannon. They were both studying film at USC. So they decided, hey, let's make a sci-fi movie for like this sort of graduate thesis project, basically. So they made this film. They enlisted a whole bunch of like fellow students to be in it and work on it and things like that. Actually, a lot of people involved with this movie go on to do bigger and better things. Obviously, John Carpenter, successful director. Dan O'Bannon, probably better known as a writer. He wrote things like Alien. Nick Castle worked on this. He goes on to play Mike Myers in the original Halloween. He also does the director. He directed The Last Starfighter. Bill Taylor, one of the visual effects people, did a whole bunch of stuff. Greg Jean, another visual effects person, went to work for like Star Trek stuff. So there's a lot of talented people on this movie. The guy who plays Doolittle is actually better known these days as an animator. He's not really an actor. He was at film school for animation, as far as I can tell. Yeah, big pedigree. So a bit of background. While they're making this movie, another student film called The Resurrection of Bronco Billy actually wins an Academy Award for Best Short Film. And John Carpenter works on this film as like editor, music. I think he did some camera work, stuff like that. And through this, he learned that USC actually owned the rights to the film rather than the filmmakers. And this sort of annoyed him because he didn't feel that was right. And when he and Dan O'Bannon collaborated to do this, it started out as a student film and it was probably about 45 minutes or so. And then reportedly, they literally broke into like USC's archives where they were holding stuff and stole the negative so that they could have it and expand it to be a feature length film. And supposedly USC, the story goes to something along the lines of they decided it's probably better for us to be associated in a positive way with this film rather than get a bunch of negative press for trying to sue John Carpenter to get it back. That sort of thing. We're going to just kind of let this one go.
That's a nice end to that. Right. Very unexpected these days.
Yeah. So the student film's about 45 minutes. They film it over the period of about 3 years, just as they have time and availability of people. And as they slowly get money, they'll film a part. And then they'll, you know, go do other things, get more money. They'll film another part. So then it gets to a point where they're like, hey, we could potentially exhibit this theatrically, but in order to do that, it needs to be longer. So they talk to a guy named Jack Murphy, who helps give them some support to film a bunch more stuff so that this thing will be feature length. And then they go to a guy named Jack Harris to be the distributor. Jack Harris distributed a lot of things, including the 50s Blob movie. That was a Jack Harris production. Supposedly, Jack Harris looks at this and goes, this is terrible. It's so slow and bloated. And they were like, yeah, we needed to make it longer to be feature length. And according to Jack Harris, he was basically like, that doesn't mean just make each scene longer. That means like make new scenes, everyone. So he insisted that I think about 30 minutes of that version be cut, and then they film like additional scenes to make up for that, to bring it back up to like feature length. And so that's the version that they released. Supposedly, Dan O'Bannon was furious about this because, you know, artist integrity, blah, blah, blah. John Carpenter, I think, was a little more pragmatic in that he also felt the same way, but knew that if he wanted this movie distributed, he had to play ball at this point because he's not a name or anything. So, yeah, so they made this movie. Dan O'Bannon on record was saying something to the effect of that Dark Star went from being the most impressive student film ever made to the least impressive professional film ever made. Yeah, that's the basic story. And then they released it. It did basically not much business, but sort of developed a cult following over the years. I think partly because of John Carpenter being attached to it. I think also it's appeals to a certain demographic of, nerds. Let's say, stoners. So yeah, it has this sort of cult reputation. And yeah, that is roughly, very quickly, the backstory of this movie.
Dan, do you want to get right into it? I want to hear your guess as to what parts or what scenes were added.
My initial guess, and kind of remains my only guess really, is the additional 35 minutes of the elevator scene.
Yes.
And unnecessary.
That's what I think too, especially since after the elevator scene, they have a scene of them walking down the hallway with their mouths away from the camera, where they dub over the guy talking about it, and then it never comes up again.
Yeah, I felt like that was a scene that could have been 15 seconds that seemed wrong for about 35 minutes.
So that is one of the scenes that was added to, originally added to bring it up to feature length. It was everything involving the alien.
Ah.
But it is not the only addition.
Oh, no.
The only other guess that I had, and this is just actually based on the credits, John Carpenter is credited as, well, on IMDb at least, like not in the credits, but as Talby voice. So I wasn't sure if that meant they did a voiceover and he was providing the voice the whole time, or did they reshoot a scene where you don't see Talby talking and he like recorded some dialogue or something?
Supposedly, the actor who was playing Talby, Andrea Pahick or something like that, had such a thick accent that John Carpenter felt compelled to just dub over it.
Oh,
like Arnold Schwarzenegger in, what was it, Conan the Barbarian, right?
I think in Conan, it's Arnold's actual voice.
I thought the original one, it was dubbed over.
Having literally watched it like 4 days ago, I can actually tell you no, that is very definitely.
Maybe Arnold did the dub.
He did the dub. The dub. Conan, oh God!
Probably ain't got no games.
Every year that goes by, as he loses his accent, he redubs it.
I do know that the original Mad Max, Mel Gibson's voice is dubbed over because they thought his voice was too Australian to understand. I don't know if that is true on current prints, like versions of the movie, but I know at least that, because I think as people got used to Mel Gibson, they just kept stuck with the Australian track soundtrack. But supposedly, yeah, the first American version, he's dubbed in that. Another possible movie I guess we could do. That's sci-fi-ish.
Yeah.
Wait, have you seen Mad Max?
I've seen them all.
Can I guess another scene that was
Yes.
cut for length? It was actually, it's a scene I enjoyed, and I liked the music in general, but the musical bottle playing scene, was that?
Yep, that is okay. Also an addition.
Got it.
That was when I was like, finally, some John Carpenter music.
Yeah.
Question, were those supposed to be jars full of his urine?
I think it's just meant to be water. I don't think
it's be like water, but urine is like canon
into
now.
A jar and then hung it up and started playing.
That would be hilarious. I didn't get that, but gosh, where do you start with this movie, or where do you go? It's a lot of different scenes stitched together, I guess.
The plot, since to the extent there is a plot.
Yeah. We haven't covered what this movie is even about yet.
Oh, that is true. We should talk about what the movie generally is about. And that seems like a great thing for Doug to do since he chose the movie.
So Dark Star is the story of a spaceship full of guys, an interstellar demolitions crew. They're just going around to new star systems, identifying whether planets are unstable. And if they are, sending bombs at them to blow them up. And it also turns out that the people who sent them on this mission maybe weren't super concerned about their well-being. So it's been a few years that they've been on this mission. What was it, like 20 years, they said?
Well, I think because of time dilation, they've actually only experienced 3 years.
Okay, so they've only been on it for 3 years, and it's 20 years after they started.
Yeah, something like
that. Well, that's a particularly shoddy build, then, for everything to be falling apart in only 3 years.
Look, that's how government works, man.
I assume that the justification for stuff like, oh, yeah, our bunk, you know, in the storeroom and all these other things self-destructed and were destroyed. I assume the point of that was just to avoid having to make additional sets.
Probably. But, although supposedly the sleeping quarters scenes are also additions.
Ah.
And what quality additions those
bits are. Look, if you didn't have that, the runtime would be too short.
If those ones are added, then I side with Dan O'Bannon on on that one. I'd have been angry too.
Did you notice that the guy playing Boiler actually stabs his finger?
No.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't. Yeah.
Supposedly, that whole sequence was unscripted. Like, he just pulled out the blade and just started playing the knife game, and that's not like they told him to do that.
Like, they were just like, pretend you've been bored for 20 years.
Yeah. There is a real knife. Go crazy.
I would have guessed that happened while they were doing student filming. Doesn't seem like a thing that would normally happen on a professional set. Like, where'd that knife come from? Hold on.
So how about first impressions as it starts? For those of us who did not know what they were in for.
With the greatest actor of our generation, guy playing Withers. Who is that? Let's find out. His name, Watkins.
Miles Watkins.
Yes, Miles Watkins playing Watkins.
Yeah, as soon as it started, the sound effects, I was like, I don't know what this movie's going to look like, but it sure does sound old.
Apparently, he also a director of things. Looks like some TV stuff. L.A. Law, Northern Exposure, Beverly Hills Now, 210 at one point.
They bothered to put the tape reels, like the computer tape reels, in the background, but didn't bother to have them moving. Like, I don't think I've ever seen them just used as static props before, ever. I don't know if that's a good thing, but it was certainly noticeable.
Just means that data bank ain't running at this point. So what was your impression, Dan, then, watching that opening scene?
The opening scene didn't leave much of an impression. It was more the sounds and the it sounded so like so dated and like student filmy.
I thought it set the tone pretty perfectly, both in terms of those sounds you're referencing. And I mean, even just kind of the, I don't remember exactly all that guy said, but there was some light humor in it. I mean, the fact that they're on this space mission and Congress doesn't feel like sending them radiation shielding or whatever it is. Like, you guys right. figure it out.
And then at the end saying like, yeah, you should call us more. Why don't you call us more?
Yeah. And then as that first scene opened on, you know, the first planet destruction, you know, I always like when they just kind of drop you in and give you a taste of what's going on and then kind of explain what's happening as they go. But I'm not sure if I ever really figured out what makes a planet, quote unquote, unstable and why it needs to be vaporized as a result.
So one of the advantages of watching this movie twice for this is I picked up the second time around some of these things.
Like, there was a line somewhere in the middle about, in like 18,000 rotations or something, this planet's going to spiral into the star and it'll go supernova. So we better destroy it now.
Will it though?
According to science, sure. I have no idea what the state of science in 1970 was.
Like a planet running into a star, will it trigger a supernova?
According to all our understanding of modern astronomy, definitely.
If the planet was big enough and the star was small stars, that doesn't make any sense.
Maybe there was a lot really of red matter on the planet.
Oh, so much red matter.
Is that a Star Trek reference?
Yes, that is a Star okay. Trek reference.
R.I.P. Vulcan.
All we need to know is that this is what they've been told that they're doing. I guess no for sure.
It was just sent to collect footage of planets being exploded for people's entertainment.
Yeah, initially I thought they were trying to destroy like intelligent life, but then I think they clarify later what they're trying to do.
Well, maybe that's what they're actually doing.
Could be.
I did note though before they revealed that they had only experienced 3 years on the ship. When I still thought they had been there for 20 years. And the one guy opened up a magazine and I was like, how many times has he read that magazine?
Not even a magazine. It was like a DC romance comic book.
Right. It was something very, very chintzy and bizarre.
There was like another one that was like Man's World or something like that, like a men's magazine.
And at one point he's reading a Doctor Strange issue.
Oh, really?
Yeah, when he's getting like the tan and the corridor. Let's see if the internet knows. What is the Doctor Strange issue in Dark Star? Doctor Strange ending post-credit scene explained. Dark Side of Doctor Strange. Yep, the MCU has ruined everything when it comes to Google searches. Maybe if I put Dark Star in quotes.
You're just going to get stuff about Dark Star, the Marvel Comics character?
Something about the Grateful Dead song Dark Star. Why I Love Dark Star from the BFI. I might save that just so we have it in the blog post. Yeah, nothing obvious offhand as to what issue it was. We could probably figure out if we freeze framed, but.
But yeah, I guess I'm going to defend the bunk scene. I really kind of liked it.
That's one of my favorite scenes.
I mean, it's just got all sorts of ridiculous stuff. Like, that's the stuff they decided to bring. Just like, googly eye glasses and a rubber
and
chicken.
And a rubber chicken. he tries so hard with it.
He really does.
And then he's like, what's wrong with him? I also like how that kind of ties in with the detail a little bit that Pinback isn't Pinback.
Right.
Yeah.
I don't know if you guys caught that, because it's definitely happening in the background of a scene at one point, his explanation of why he's there.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Wait, was that meant to be an actual truthful explanation?
I think so, yeah.
Or was he just, you know, making up a story for fun?
I think you're meant to believe that is genuinely why he's there.
Because later in his diary, he explains, like, his clothes don't fit, because they're not his clothes. The underwear are too
big. So that was odd, though. I ended up with a different take on that, because the video diary thing, he went back and forth from like sounding like a complete ignoramus to somebody who actually was sophisticated. And I wondered if they were showing like that he was descending into like a schizophrenic like madness or something from the isolation of being on the ship or something. Because like, I actually thought the best line in the movie was when he said, they are uncouth and fail to appreciate my better qualities.
I was like, I'm going to write this down.
I totally wrote that down. I gotta work that into a conversation at some point at work over the next week. That's the new challenge.
I'm going to tell my boss about this.
I kind of decided to take it the other way, which is that, yeah, he was telling the truth, but like as he's been on the ship, he's become like very concerned about things being done the right way, even though he's not supposed to be there. It's like, these guys don't even care about this ship.
Because he definitely, like, once he's on the ship and, you know, they're doing the blowing up the bombs things, like he's right there in the control room, running the control board, hitting the buttons, knows what he's doing. And somebody who scored a 58 when they were supposed to be a minimum 700, I'm not sure that they would even like know how to read the instruction manual.
Look, it's a real testament to the effectiveness of on-the-job training.
I guess so. Especially if you say, if you screw this up, we're all going to be vaporized.
Right.
Look, it's all highly automated. I mean, the bombs practically blow up themselves.
The bombs, I noted, are smart bombs.
They are.
Yeah. I also liked in the bunk scene that they had the bunk for the guy who we presume is completely dead up until near the end of the movie. Like, and they've got his, I think, like, medals or something laid out, and it's, like, very neatly made. So they just decided to keep his bunk there as a tribute to him.
Speaking of which, did you notice that guy is on the poster? At least the online version of the poster.
Oh, no.
Yeah, and he's in the movie for like 30 seconds near the end.
I mean, he packs a punch when he shows up, though, I'd say. That's
a memorable
image,
yeah. Sure, yeah.
It not definitely is.
Leaving my brain very quickly.
Yeah, I very much enjoyed the remark that, oh yeah, Paul's always been pretty lucky as his frozen body flies past.
I just also like how he wants to know how the Dodgers are doing after he's like explained to, like, we're in a crisis situation.
Again, saying like, yeah, well, you will come talk to me when you need something. But that was a pretty good reveal, because they don't really tip their hat before that. They're like, we got to go talk to him. Wait, what?
Yeah, yeah. I definitely didn't see it coming.
Near the beginning, when the asteroid storm hits, I enjoyed how they're just sort of relaxing, and the computer is just very gently, very slowly trying to get their attention. You know, it wants them to know that there's a horrible emergency, and so after wasting all this time being so gentle about it, they have to just absolutely scramble.
And oh, by the way, all the shields are malfunctioning. You gotta save yourselves.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah, I noticed how like sultry the computer sounded the whole time.
Yeah.
But there was like, so there was the ship shields, and then was there like a shield over them too, or they're like suspended animation? So, yeah. Yeah. It's kind of interesting. They just put that on the screen and you're kind of meant to figure out what's going on.
They didn't spoon feed you in the '70s, man.
Yeah, I know. I liked all that.
Had more
stuff.
Faith in their audience.
Who was your favorite character?
The ball. I liked the ball.
The ball.
I mean, it was,
giant testicle.
A little bit too much, but I did like it. Would have been perfect if the beach ball had been in it for like 5 minutes. The 20-minute sequence of chasing him was a little extreme, but
especially
I like
with a 35-minute elevator shaft scene.
Yes. Speaking of the elevator shaft scene, was he laying on his stomach and it was just filmed as if it was from above? I was trying to figure out how they did that. Okay, that makes sense.
He's on a plank. The plank has some bend to it, so that's why it's moving more than you might think if you were just laying on a board.
Mm-hmm.
But as Doug pointed out while we were watching it, you can tell by the direction of his hair.
Yeah.
Gravity. Gravity and 70s haircuts.
But I think Dan O'Bannon playing Pinback, I think he sells it pretty well. Like, I know the first time I watched it, I was like, oh, how did they do that? Like, that looks real.
He did a really good job with his body, even the way, yeah, like, he was keeping his legs, quote-unquote, dangling. Like, it worked pretty well, even once you knew what was happening.
Yeah, agreed.
I think one of the main things that made it feel disjointed, beyond just the fact that plot-wise it can be completely excised, is that it's kind of a suspenseful scene in a movie that doesn't have like anything quite like that. Otherwise, like, you're like, oh, is he going to get across this plank? Is he going to get to the other side? Oh, is he going to get in the elevator? Now he's hanging off the bottom of it. At least quite a bit of it isn't played for laughs. I think towards the end, when the elevator shoves in his face like two or three times, like, that's supposed to be funny. But like leading up to that, it's like, oh, okay, a different kind of movie here.
It feels like an intermission in the middle of the actual movie where it's right, like, now here's a short about this guy's adventures. And then we will return you to your film already in progress.
I thought for a while that he was going to die in that shaft like pretty quickly. And then it was going to be a movie about everyone dying one by one.
So you were expecting Alien.
Yeah. Like, farcical Alien.
I mean, I'm kind of with you. I didn't actually know if he was going to get crushed or not, or fall.
Yeah,
yeah, same here. I thought that was going to be his demise. I also did think that it was kind of odd that this, like, supercomputer that's, you know, very, like, intelligent and in tune with everything going on the ship is, like, sentient enough to be able to warn him to get out of the elevator shaft, but then doesn't have the ability to, like, stop the elevator.
Look, man, you're bound by your programming.
We're about to kill you on purpose.
That was just an automated warning.
But then did we ever figure out why the elevator was even moving? There was nobody on it. It's just going up and down, like, completely, seemingly in random spurts.
Look, you gotta grease those servos, right? Gotta make sure they don't seize.
Yeah.
Pre-programmed preventative maintenance, I guess.
Yeah. See, yeah. Perfect movie. Sure. Nothing to explain here.
I mean, they probably could have explained it, though, like, easily, just like somebody goes up and like, oh, I forgot something. I need to go back down the elevator.
Probably would have broken up the scene a little and made it more entertaining. As it was, I found that scene to be an extraordinary bore.
It
was
does
like,
drag
can
on.
We just kill this guy or not, like, and get to the next scene?
Look, man, you got to hit feature length.
Even if it means the viewers pick up the remote and start fast forwarding.
They can't do that. They're in a movie theater. All they can do is get up and leave.
Well, there's your popcorn break, your refill.
Yeah. Well, look, your feelings were that, oh, can we just kill this guy already? My feelings were that jerk of an alien is just being a huge jerk, got him in this horrible situation. Can we get through with this scene and then kill the alien already?
Hey, he's a prankster.
What was it doing to his back? Was it clawing at him?
It was
or
tickling him.
It was tickling
him. Yeah, he's hanging on for dear life, and it's tickling him.
But, I mean, all the times that it, you know, quote-unquote, attacked him, was it always tickling him? Because it jumped on top of him a few times, didn't it?
Yeah, towards the beginning it does.
There were times it felt more like a strangle.
Yeah, exactly.
But he also laughs, too.
I almost never knew. Like, I was like, oh, this is a horror movie. Oh, this is a comedy. Like, No,
it's a public service announcement about the dangers of unsolicited horseplay. But it's interesting that Paul, at least, was expecting people to sort of start dying, because in sort of retrospect, I think you can see the influences that this movie has on O'Bannon's later script of Alien, and that there are many similar sort of feelings and qualities. It's just in that they're not ostensibly for laughs. And supposedly Dan O'Bannon is on record as saying after he like went to a showing or two and saw how the movie was being received, which is to say they were not laughing. supposedly he said something like, well, if I can't make them laugh, I'll just scare the hell out of them instead. And so went off and wrote Alien.
All right. I like the elevator shaft scene too, because I actually, it reminded me of that fight scene in They Live. So I don't know how much John Carpenter was part of that, this scene, but where it just keeps going and eventually it just gets funny. And it's like, all right, now we're going to slam his face with the elevator and then he's going to get stuck in it. And he's got to reach for all these buttons and just like all the trials that he has to get through. Like, it drags on, but eventually it just starts to get funny again.
Yeah, I don't hate it, but I do agree with, like, Dan and others that it is too long.
Yeah.
They should have cut more of it. And interestingly, one of the differences between the quote-unquote original edition, which is about 12 minutes shorter than the theatrical version, I would have to double-check, but my memory is that scene is shorter. It's still there, and it's still fairly lengthy, but it's not quite as lengthy, is my memory.
And then the cap to the scene where he goes and he shoots the alien. And I was like,
it does pop like a beach ball.
It does.
And I like how he's talking about it afterwards. He's like, did you know it was just filled with gas? How did it survive? It was just filled with gas.
Which is like, I don't know. I thought it was pretty clever. Just like, all right, we know. It's just a beach ball. At least we can call ourselves out on it, you know?
So can we talk a little bit about Pinback?
Okay.
Can we talk a little bit about how much his appearance reminds me of Paul Wilcox?
Yes.
Yeah, that's fair.
Like when I have a mental image of Paul Wilcox, it's basically Sergeant Pinback. That's all. That's just what I wanted to share.
Yeah, long-haired Paul looks fairly similar.
You know, I just had to look this up, but apparently the band Pinback is a reference to the character from Dark Star.
Wow.
Yeah.
Any songs of theirs that I might know?
I don't know. I would have to know some first. To...
Well, it was like a real big impact band.
I knew that I had heard of them before, and I was like, oh, like the band.
My favorite thing is when I look on Wikipedia for Pinback. And you know how, like, sometimes names are highlighted? If I click the name of the drummer, Chris Prescott, the article that comes up is Pinback.
You may know this guy from the page that you're on.
How about the special effects? Anything else to say on the special effects?
I think one thing to keep in mind is that motion control's not really a thing at this point.
What does that mean?
So, like, you can't program a model and a camera to sort of move simultaneously while like your Starfield shifts or something like that. Like you have to basically do all that motion in camera, so to speak. So you have to make sure everything's tracking at the same rate and that sort of thing. Basically the stuff that Star Wars is famous for was developed in large part for Star Wars. Although supposedly the scene of them going to hyperspace and the stars start to streak past was more or less invented for this movie.
Oh, really?
And we know George Lucas watched this movie, if for no other reason than he also went to USC, so he was in touch with people there. But also Dan O'Bannon worked on Star Wars doing effects, in part because of his experience from this movie. Fun
fact. I did
notice
that like hyperspeed part and was kind of conscious of like, I'm pretty sure this was a few years before Star Wars. So it seems innovative.
Yeah, so it's after 2001, but before Star Wars, so.
Yeah. The other special effect that I really liked was when they were in the asteroid field and the asteroid hits the ship, it felt very 8-bit Nintendo game. It just shows the ship and it's fine, and then there's a crackly sound effect, and suddenly this asteroid is, like, stuck to the ship like a freeze frame. It took me back, man.
But I think particularly given, you know, that they're basically working on not much money and just inventing a lot of this stuff in camera, they do a good job.
I agree that this is pretty decent special effect wise for whatever shoestring budget they were on. Though I know there were just to go back to making fun of it, because I like making fun of things. There was at least one occasion where the spaceship just came to an abrupt halt in space, which something about it always cracks me up whenever I see that in shows, just completely defying the laws of physics. Like, suddenly you hit the brakes and the ship stops. Cracks me up.
Look, man, they got those inertial dampers.
Oh, speaking of inertial dampers, so this was before Star Wars. What did the... I don't even remember if I've seen the original, like, Star Trek warp speed. Like, was it that much different from the original Star Trek warp speed? Like, original, not remastered warp speed effect?
I guess I'd have to double check to be sure, but I don't know that we ever really see the ship at warp. We see it moving past like a stationary camera.
I guess you're right.
But I don't know that we really see like streaking stars going by or anything like that.
I might be superimposing my Next Generation images with the original series. You could be right.
Sure. And I think instead you get lots of like tense bridge scenes. You know, Scotty looking worried in a Jeffries tube or whatever.
Of course.
Rather than seeing the ship moving from the outside.
This is, one of those movies where it's kind of hard for me to separate the fact I know what it is ahead of time. Like, I knew, like, at least knew in the background that it was, like, a student movie and they had, like, changed it over the course of time. So I was giving it a lot of leeway for that. Whereas, I guess if I was in the theater in 1975, I don't know what I would have thought of it.
It did pretty quickly give off the appearance of having been filmed in someone's basement. So had I paid to see this, like, as you said, in theaters in the 70s, I think it would have been a very different experience than me watching it for free without having to leave my home now and immediately understanding what was in store for me.
I just assumed this whole podcast would be a discussion about the dangers of AI.
I mean, I did really like that part.
I mean, it's the dangers of putting AI in completely unnecessary things, because like the main AI was actually, generally speaking, pretty helpful. It was the bomb that got to make decisions on its own that was maybe less ideal. <Yeah.
laughs> The bomb it's a warning against the dangers of IoT devices.
Yes, exactly.
But in defense of the bomb, it did come back in, what, three times before that?
Three out of three, you're right.
Yeah.
Rule of three. That's comedy.
Oh, and as a Star Trek fan, I did love... They didn't logic the AI to death, but they did use some sort of weird logic on it to convince it to do a thing. I don't know if that was anything resembling a callback, but a callback that is to...
Or someone Captain had just Kirk. Taken a philosophy class. And
yeah. Is phenomenology... Does it rely on logic? I don't really know that kind of
philosophy, I guess. Well, I don't know. There's an inherent
philosophy.
Phenomenology is the... What is it? It's like the opposite of existentialism or something?
I did look up what phenomenology was, and to the best of my ability to understand it, it's just the idea of how do you know what you know?
Yeah.
So essentially much. What was presented on screen. Like, how do you know that's real?
Yeah, how do you determine the difference between objective and subjective realities?
Well, I don't think that was what he was trying to argue to the bomb here, though.
No, but I think that's the general thrust of phenomenology.
I did very much enjoy the feeling of dread from the crew members as they realize what the bomb is about to do. Like, as it starts quoting scripture at them. Like, in the end, there was only darkness and me, the bomb.
Oops, bomb? With the bomb now thinks it's God.
Okay. That was quick.
This is going to end well.
I also like how Doolittle was very prepared to do what he needed to do. Like, he's like, all right, I got to get through the basics of this real quick. He's very good at explaining it.
It's something they trained you for. That's how you get that 700 on the right.
Now that you mention it, that had to have been one of those students who just had a philosophy class.
I liked how, in stride the survivors took everything once their ship exploded. Like, I mean, they weren't like happy about it, but they didn't seem all that upset. And Doolittle was so excited to surf himself to death, which I think was my favorite moment of the movie.
Yes, it's funny you say that, because that was also, I wrote down not just like ironically or as a joke, but the end was my favorite part.
Oh, for sure. It was fantastic.
When he grabs the space junk and surfs his way to the planet.
Part of me wondered if that sequence was a sort of parody of 2001, where Talby shoots off into space and Doolittle goes to get him and like he's yelling. And Doolittle's like, stop panicking. You'll be fine. Calm down. And I wondered how direct
that,
a reference
that definitely that was. Did give big, yeah, big 2001 vibes, that whole scene.
Yeah, I mean, this is not too until many years after.
Until it became Dr. Strangelove at the end. Yeah.
I was hoping he was going to ride the bomb down. That was really what I was hoping for in the conclusion there.
That would have been good. I also thought it was funny that a bomb that's big enough to like vaporize an entire planet goes off 100 feet from him and just knocks him sideways.
Anyway, ship's computer made it clear that she was going to use dampers to reduce the radius of the explosion to a mile.
Mm.
That was before it even got back into the bomb bay. So
far, every like little quibbly like piece of, you know, logic we throw at this movie has accounted for.
Strangely, yeah.
They knew how to make them back in the day, 50 years ago.
Then in that case, help me with this one. Why did they turn off that guy's mic that was like trying to fix the bomb room as they were on their bomb mission?
They were on their bomb mission. They had a mission to do. They didn't need distractions. Doolittle just straight up did not care what Talby was up to.
And he didn't know he was in the bomb room.
Yes.
He just knew he had found the malfunction somewhere and he did not think it was relevant.
He didn't care about the malfunction in the first from the get-go.
See, that's the importance of eating with your coworkers, you know, socializing with your coworkers. You know, like you gotta build a relationship there so that it doesn't end up that you go off doing something on your own, being a go-getter, and then everybody dies as a result.
It's a workplace comedy.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it got me my speech to give to my
They are uncouth and fail to appreciate my better qualities.
That's the one.
I feel like I should write this down myself. So we talked a little bit about the alien scene matching Alien, but I think also the general vibe of the crew on the Dark Star is very similar to the vibe on the Nostromo, right? And that these are working stiffs in space, right? They're like truck drivers, sort of, right? It's not the Star Trek universe or the 2001. These aren't, despite like certain speeches, these aren't really like highly trained astronauts. You know, this isn't the right stuff. Right. At least that's the impression that the movie gives. And so I just wondered what other people thought about that sort of vibe.
Yeah, it definitely felt like they were at work, not like super scientist types. They were just dudes on a ship at work doing a thing.
I enjoyed it. It's certainly more, I don't know, the Expanse-y or maybe to a lesser extent Firefly-y than Star Trek. I don't know how common that was, particularly in the era that this was released in. So yeah, no, I thought that was an interesting direction they took it in.
Yeah, definitely their attitude was pretty amusing to me. It's like, no, we don't care about that, or turning off people's mics so they didn't want to hear him, or
we'll fix it when it breaks.
Pinback, who was sitting in the seat next to where the captain was killed, and he keeps mentioning like, can they fix that? I'm nervous.
That whole scene is fantastic, where he keeps leaning in and whispering. I loved that.
Now Doolittle has to say it because he's sitting right there.
Yeah, I did think though that seemed kind of antithetical to like the minimum IQ or whatever, the test scores they had to do. Whereas like, I don't know, it seems like as a bunch of working stiffs on a multiple year or multiple decade mission or whatever, the test they would have had to have taken would have been like some sort of a personality test to make sure they weren't going to all go crazy and kill each other in 5 years from the isolation and everything, you know?
I mean, yeah, maybe that would have been a good test to give them, but I'm willing to believe that they gave them some dumb, unrepresentative test that doesn't really mean anything.
Because they were definitely all seemed to be losing it there near the end. Oh, one one bit I was going to mention. Did anyone else notice that Talby's spacesuit had a muffin tin?
No.
Is that what that was?
Yeah, it's like a kid's space helmet that doesn't really fit him, and then a muffin tin on the front.
That part definitely made me laugh.
Okay, this is going to bug me. So I do want to go back to it. I'm unclear if I missed something or if you all missed something, but I definitely got the impression that Pinback was just telling a long-form joke with the thing about not really being a spaceman. Because throughout that whole scene, the other two guys are like, he told us this 4 years ago, didn't he? Yeah, I'm sure he told us this story 4 years ago.
No, it was actually 4 years ago.
Yeah, right?
That's what I said.
I think funny exchange. I think that's supposed to be the real story, and they've just heard it, so they're completely uninterested because they know all this. That, I think, is the interpretation we're meant to take.
Yeah, that he's.
I think the opposite is the interpretation you're meant to take.
I don't think that's true.
I think he has multiple personality disorder or schizophrenia.
Yeah, I mean, he's talking about how, you know, these spaceman people, you know, I thought they were supposed to all get these sort of mental examinations and stuff, really rigorous. And here this guy just jumps into my liquid oxygen tank or whatever it was. I think that was his way of kind of saying to them that he's kind of cracking up a bit.
I disagree with you, but that's fine.
So you think that they genuinely had a spaceman go insane and get replaced without anyone noticing?
Yes.
You think that is the more rational explanation than that the whole thing was a confabulation?
I don't know, there's rationality going on here.
Yeah. How much credit are we giving to the people who sent them on this mission?
So I like how all the crew interacts, too. Like, Doolittle talking with Talby, like, come down and talk with us. You need to really be part of the crew and, like, relate to people. But then he's completely ignores Pinback. He doesn't have any time for him.
That sounds like a workplace.
Yeah, it does. I know.
So, Doug, you chose the movie. Do you regret that decision? Are you glad you watched it? Somewhere in the middle?
It was maybe a little bit lower quality than, you know, student film and all than I was expecting. But, you know, you wanted some science fiction that wasn't from the 2010s. So this is what you got. And I think personally that it really excelled at that. So in that regard, smash hit, perfect choice on my part. Good job, Doug. I understood the assignment to use outdated lingo from social media.
What did others think?
I enjoyed it. I don't think I'm going to go out of my way to watch it ever again, but I enjoy low budget sci-fi. And, you know, my pick, whenever that was a couple episodes ago, Teenagers from Outer Space. I mean, low budget 50s sci-fi has a very different vibe from low budget 70s sci-fi. And yeah, it was a nice change up. I was entertained, and that's really all I can look for when watching something that has a budget of a hundredth of what a normal movie at the time would be going for. So thank you, Doug. I enjoyed it.
I guess I'll go back the other way. I did not like it. I found it very difficult to watch, in particular that elevator scene just dragged on. There was a moment in there where I literally turned to my wife, who was laying on the couch doing her best to ignore it, and me, and I was like, I don't know if I can watch this. I think I'm going to have to turn it off and, like, find a summary online. Like,
I watched it. I need to cliff notes this.
Yes. I was like, I don't know if I can sit through this. And it definitely, like, that scene ended and it picked up a bit again once they got kind of back to the, you know, what everybody else was up to on the ship. And I definitely think it picked up near the end with Talby in his muffin tin space suit trying to fix the laser. And especially after the bomb went off and they're, you know, floating through space, I thought it was a pretty funny sequence. And a couple of seemingly random things from earlier, like the monologue about surfing, like, suddenly came back, you know, and like came full circle, but it wasn't quite enough to save it for me. So I wouldn't particularly look to watch it again. I think I gave it a generous D. And that's it. That's considering it's you know, low budget and time and place and student movie and all that. But I didn't care for it.
Thank you for at least finishing it.
I did finish it.
I want to chime in for a second. It's funny you mentioned watching this with your wife, because my wife came down to see what I was watching. I told her I'm watching a movie for the podcast, and she wordlessly turned around and went back upstairs because she watched at least half of Fantastic Planet with me and now knows what we usually watch for the podcast.
Dan, did you at least enjoy Benson, Arizona?
The song?
Benson, Arizona.
I don't know that I realized that song was Benson, Arizona.
Written special for the movie.
But it wasn't a bad song.
Yeah.
Okay.
They did keep coming back to that song, and it was not a bad song. I'll give you that.
I'm going to swing back the opposite direction. I really, really liked this movie. It was weird. Like, I think it did a good job with the tone, like, understanding that, okay, they knew it was a student movie, and it was just felt in a lot of ways like a series of scenes. Like, we didn't know really where the plot was going, but I think it kind of worked. And like, each scene was kind of unique and funny for its own reasons. I laughed a lot when I watched this. Even the elevator scene, once it got to the point where it was ridiculous, I started to be amused by that again.
And at what point was that? Was that 30 seconds into it? 15 minutes into it?
It's like 15 minutes in. When he gets hit like the second time in the face by the elevator, it's like inching down. You're like, this is not how elevators behave.
And then he got stuck in the bottom of it and hit the button to self-clean it, and it just exploded. Like, oh, that's how you clean things.
I don't know. And the John Carpenter music was fun. I liked the scene with the self-made piano and just him sitting listening to the bottles clanking after he was done playing.
I really liked that one as well.
It's got like a lot of memorable stuff. And while it doesn't quite seem to cohere, and like, I don't really know how to explain the plot of this movie very well, I thought I enjoyed watching it. So I don't know if I'd recommend it to other people, though. Like, it was definitely like, as I was watching it, I was like, I really enjoy this movie. I'm not sure other people would enjoy this movie as much as I do.
I will say, on the student movie part of it, it's probably a good idea, a good thing that Adam gave me a heads up that that's what it was, because he, in explaining the difference between the theatrical cut and the non-theatrical cut, I was like, how do I know? And he mentioned the Dan O'Bannon quote about it going from the most impressive student film to the least impressive professional film. Had I not realized that was a student film going into it, I'd have been like, okay, I think Adam may have reached out to me on like April Fool's Day. I think he's...
Yeah, it was kind of, it was fun watching a non-self-serious like space movie. I mean, I know they exist, but I mean...
It was last Friday that you mentioned that.
Okay. It was April 1st.
It was April 1st when we were talking about the theatrical versus not theatrical.
As an aside, because Charlie was saying, how do you even describe this movie? What it's about? This predates Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, right?
Yes.
Like, entirely, right?
Yep.
Okay. Because they're basically Vogons, right? In terms of their job.
Roughly, yeah.
Good call.
Show up, blow up some planets for construction purposes. Move on.
Just how Doolittle's like, let's just blow up the planet. Come on.
It's gotta go something to blow up.
Yeah. I did like the scene where he's like, what are you gonna name it? He's like, who cares? I was like, Commander Powell would have named it.
He got very pouty.
Yeah. Paul?
Yeah, I liked it. I don't know if I've seen anything quite like it. I think it kind of nailed the vibe that it was going for. I, you know, liked a good number of the scenes. Got some good laughs out of it. And yeah, really liked the song as well.
I guess I'm somewhere kind of in the middle. I can definitely see what Dan's saying about it's not paced well. at least particularly a theatrical cut. I mentioned that I watched the quote unquote original cut, which seems to be a re-edit that Dan O'Bannon and maybe John Carpenter did to bring it kind of closer to what their intention was before they were asked to pad it out a bunch. And it does move a little better there because certain scenes are missing, whether you like them or not. So like the musical instrument scene is gone. All the bunk scenes are missing. Like I said, I don't think the elevator scene is quite as protracted. But I think some of the actually also the plot stuff is actually kind of missing too. Like there's not as much of like the asteroid stuff or all the issues with the laser. So, but in some ways, making it shorter does kind of make it better. And so seeing the theatrical version, yeah, it definitely does sag. But as I watch this more times, what I sort of really appreciate is just the vibe of it all. Like this most recent time, I found myself caring less about like what the plot is and what they're trying to do and aim and stuff, and more just sort of enjoying the atmosphere that is being generally constructed with the movie and just that kind of relaxed feel, even when crazy things are happening. And I do like that it kind of ends on a downer and that everyone dies, but well, except Commander Powell, I guess. He's the lucky.
Talby will be back around in another trillion years.
Yeah. I guess that's true. Yeah. So
he's off with this. With what were those?
Phoenix asteroids.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They go around like, every 13 trillion years or something like that.
But I like that just kind of like slacker, but not downer necessarily vibe. Like I enjoyed that. I also don't know that I'd really recommend this to other people. But I think if people were like, oh, I've kind of been interested in trying out Darkstar, I don't know that I would immediately go, oh, don't do that. And part of me kind of wonders how influential this movie was. Because, like, obviously there's things like Alien, but, and then Doug mentioned things like Hitchhiker's Guide. Kind of feels like Red Dwarf might have taken some stuff from this movie. Yeah, just a lot of that sort of, like, sci-fi, working class, vaguely absurdist stuff that sometimes shows up. I wonder how much of that is influenced by Darkstar. But yeah, that's my take. A tepid thumbs up, I guess. I don't know. I guess if we were actually grading these, I don't know, B minus maybe, C plus. Better than a D, I'll say that. Well, thank you, Dan, for joining us here on the Sci-Fi Shuffle and enduring Darkstar. as your reward, you get to inflict a movie on us.
I definitely looked into a few, trying to figure out what might be worthy of this podcast that maybe not everyone has seen. And I've settled on a couple, one that looks thrilling and one that looks funny. Would people be more interested in a thriller or something funny? Neither of them from the 2010s, I might add.
Great. Thank you.
So Adam's already satisfied.
I might go thriller just because we just ostensibly watched a comedy in theory.
Sort of on a funny streak, really. The last, like.
Yeah, because we watched Teenagers from Outer Space. Yeah, so maybe a thriller might be better.
Another one that I've never heard of until I started Googling, underrated sci-fi movies and stuff like that. Dark City from 1998.
Oh, yeah. I've definitely seen that one.
Roger Ebert loves that movie.
Did we watch that together, Adam?
No.
Oh, okay. I know we were watching.
Everybody's already seen.
I watched that Holmes Hall at some point. Yeah.
But
should I pick a different one?
I haven't.
No, that's fine.
I've never seen it either.
I mean, I guess if the goal is to.
Well, I don't know. Is that the goal?
Not necessarily. I think you're perfectly within your rights to pick any movie that we just haven't discussed. Like, we started with 2001. So I think it's totally fine to do movies that people have seen.
And it was 20 years ago. So. Might as well be new.
Yeah, it was a while ago.
All right, well, thanks for choosing Dark City for us. Another dark movie.
Yes, that I also thought could provide some continuity, strangely.
So thanks, Dan, and thanks to everyone else for joining us. Kevin Vredevogue.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Doug Gobeski.
It was a pleasure to be here.
And Paul Wilcox.
Thanks for having me.
And once again, very special guest, Dan Hess.
Extra special, thank you.
Extra special, yes. And on behalf of the Gobeski Wallace Report, I'm Adam Gobeski.
And I'm Charlie Wallace.
And we'll see you in the future.
Darkness.
The nightmarish dark future.
Ever-shifting future, yes.
Bye! that's our show. Thanks for listening. We hope you check us out. Don't forget you can visit our website at www.gobeskywallacereport.com.
Also, we're on Facebook and Twitter, so make sure to look for us there for extra entertaining bits.
You will be entertained. Possibly.
Wait, so you're definitely entertained, but only possibly entertained.
Well, I don't want to get sued for false advertising.
Sorry, tip their hand, I think is what I wanted to say instead of tip their hat. But
you can say it now and through the power of editing.
Yeah, I like how they don't really tip their hat to the fact that he's still alive until.
Are you kidding me?
Damn it, Charlie.
You know you said it again, right?
That was
I just wanted the
right?
Yes, I hope. The best version.
Charlie out here trying to manufacture tags.